104.4 Resonance FM, presented by me, Tom Hamilton, and Neil Denny. Little Atoms is a show about ideas. We invite interesting people to talk about interesting things, and today's interesting person is Terry Glavin.
Terry Glavin is an award-winning author and journalist. He is an adjunct professor in the Department of Creative Writing at the University of British Columbia and editor of Transmontanus Books. Some of his previous books include This Ragged Place, Travels Across the Landscape, and The Last Great Sea. But he's here tonight to discuss his new book, The Lost and Left Behind, Stories from the Age of Extinctions. Terry, thanks for joining us on Little Atoms.
Thank you very much for having me.
So, as per the subtitle, the book is about extinctions, but it's not just about flora and fauna, and you talk about extinctions of ecosystems, cultures and ways of life and languages. Just so tell us a little bit about why you wrote the book, basically. Why I was going to say what inspired you, but it's quite a depressing subject. Inspired is probably not the right word.
No, it's that's a good word. But what I've done with it is I've done what I'm not supposed to do, and what I'm not supposed to do is be optimistic about these things. Mm-hmm. And what I'm not supposed to do is begin a book like this, and come away from it at the end of the book with a far higher regard and deeper affection for my fellow human beings than I had when I began. I wrote it because, just to cite the epigraph, is this. Everything one writes now is overshadowed by this ghastly feeling that we are rushing towards a precipice, and though we shan't actually prevent ourselves or anyone else from going over, must put up some sort of a fight. And that was what George Orwell wrote in a letter to Cyril Connolly on the 14th of December, 1938. And the case that I make is that, indeed, everything that you hear, all the frightening headlines that one encounters about these sorts of things, environmental degradation, ecosystem collapse, species extinction, and so on, these are not exaggerations. And indeed, the struggles that we face are every bit as daunting as the struggles that faced our parents and grandparents in the mid-20th century in the fight against totalitarianism and fascism. This is something that we actually have to take very seriously. Mm-hmm. But my quarrel, my argument, is that we've been talking about all of this in a very foolish way for the last 30 years, a very narrow way. We've imagined that we've allowed ourselves to accept this sort of the dominant meta-narrative, if you like, of environmentalism, which unfortunately tends to place nature outside of culture, puts the biosphere away from the ethnosphere, and creates this sort of imaginary but impermeable wall between the wild and the tamed, the living and the dead, language and landscape, and so on. And it's the way we've been talking about this that is unhelpful. Not just about the wild, it's also about the tamed. What we're seeing is, without question, a mass extinction event. We haven't seen anything like this in the last 65 million years. It's only six times in the history of life on this planet, so far as we know, that extinctions have been galloping at this rate, at least 10 times the normal sort of background rate of extinction. But at the same time, we're losing functions of artificial selection, food crop varieties, domesticated animals, everything. And also, we're losing an entire human language every 2 weeks. So we're losing entire cosmologies, bodies of literature. It's as though vast libraries just burst into flame every 2 weeks. So we shouldn't be talking about nature and this phenomenon as though it were separate and apart from what's befalling everything else.
Well, you talk about this idea that's through environmentalism, I suppose, that this is a modern phenomenon, and you know, to do with sort of a modern way of life. And one of the things I really like about the book is there's a number of, I suppose, myths about sort of nature that you dispel. And one of these is this idea that Aboriginal peoples around the world are somehow more holistic and in tune with nature. But you paint a picture that sort of describes pretty much wherever mankind has gone, extinction has followed pretty much closely behind.
Yeah, pretty well. Whenever there's a sort of a disruption or a collapse of order, ecological order, extinctions follow. And wherever there's a collapse of order, quite often, extinctions follow in culture as well. The extinction event that we are now witnessing and has been, you know, thoroughly and completely documented, didn't begin with modern people. In fact, it began, if we like to think of the last 10,000 years, as the Anthropocene epoch, mm-hmm. Where human beings have actually had an enormous impact on ecosystems throughout the planet, far more than we generally appreciate. The greatest extinctions, actually, of the most fabulous bestiary of animals. I mean, some of them are just unbelievable. A bird as big as a Cessna in Florida, pygmy elephants in Sicily, no bigger than a pony. I mean, it just goes on and on, these wonderful animals. But these extinctions actually happened between 50 and 10,000 years ago. Some of them are actually quite recent. By recent, I mean 1,000, 2,000 years ago, these waves of extinction. The notion that modern human beings have been willfully and negligently engaged in the sort of rapacity that we associate with industrial society is actually not borne out by the facts. Mm-hmm. And the idea that human beings don't care, which is actually completely underlines the environmentalist narrative. And I feel, don't get me wrong, I mean, I actually still, every once in a while, will do some research contracts with environmental organizations. I consider environmentalists to be, generally speaking, our comrades. But the underlying narrative makes a presumption that human beings don't care and have to be made to care. But in fact, we do. Human beings have been naturally selected to care. The E.O. Wilson's biophilia hypothesis, I think, is something that's very compelling, that this is something that's central and inherent in the nature of the human species, that we have always had this capacity to extend the embrace of our empathy to include other species. And we actually want to be living in a world that is flourishing in the abundance and diversity of other forms of life. That is true across cultures. It is true throughout human history. That's an important thing to remember.
There's also the danger, isn't there, that if you have this narrative of humans bad, wild things good, right, then you end up placing certain kinds of certain groups of people, tribes, people that we might think of as primitive, on the wild side of that divide,
exactly,
and end up effectively dehumanizing them. Really,
oh, perfect word. That's exactly what we do. We dehumanize. When you look at North America, most people think of, in this sort of paradigm, the idea of humans living in some sort of sacred balance with nature. This is something that entered the European consciousness to a great extent because of stories that were coming back from the so-called New World, mm-hmm. which is actually in many cases the Old World, but never mind. And we have Rousseau and his idea of the noble savage. And people are reluctant to accept the notion that, in fact, most people in North America prior to the advent of Columbus and infectious diseases that took away probably 90% of the people of North America, that most folks were actually town-dwelling agriculturalists. They weren't these sort of Neolithic hippies in loincloths wandering around the forest with pointed sticks. This is not in any way to sort of disparage or to suggest that they were every bit as rapacious as we are. It's not as simple as that. The cultural diversity, the diversity of experience in the New World was spectacular, was fantastic. The city of Tenochtitlan at the time of the conquistadors was larger than Paris. So the closer that you look at the sort of fundamental plinths of this structure that we have built that embodies the environmental narrative, none of the, where they do exist, they're cracked. But in fact, in most cases, they don't even exist at all. So what I'm arguing here, actually, and the book begins with a sort of a meditation on the United Nations Environment Program's Global Outlook Report, which looked ahead to the year 2032 and said, well, where are we going with this, right? And there's actually, it's not particularly bleak. There's actually four sort of trajectories that they imagined. And the last report, interestingly, of the United Nations Environment Program's Global Environment Outlook report just came out today. And it's all over the front page of the, I haven't seen the other papers because I've been on the road, but it comes, it's all over the front page of the Times, two pages inside by the Science Reporter and the Environment Reporter, the entire, well, half of the editorial page. And what was, I think, in a twisted kind of way, heartening to me about this was that the findings of that report and the assessment of it by the Times of London editorialist reads like a précis of this book, which is a very sort of strange experience because I can't sort of remember agreeing very much with the Times of London's editorials before. But the point that was being made there was we have to forget that this isn't just about some nature, some ideas, you know, these lovely animals out there in the wild. This is about us. This isn't about... it was a very odd experience reading a headline that said, suggested the human species was at risk, and then reading an editorial in the same newspaper saying, headlines that suggest that the human species are at risk are really stupid. Well, they should probably... Maybe the editorial pages editor might talk to some of the headline writers from time to time. But this is actually a really important point to make. This is not about whether the human species will survive. It is about how we will survive. It is about how we will share the limited natural resources of this planet equitably and fairly and efficiently. It's about the how we will go about the business of living together on this Earth as a species and distributing wealth and opportunity. And so fundamentally, these are political conversations that we should be having. They're cultural conversations that we should be having. We should take it out of this subset of the counterculture discourse and make it central to the way we understand the way our economy functions and the way nation states function and the way international institutions like the United Nations function.
Okay, well, you talked about earlier about how extinction sort of accelerates when cultures are collapsing or in decline, and there's a great example of this in the book. And if you'd like to talk to us for a bit about your journeys in the sort of Far East of the former
Russia.
Soviet Union.
Yeah, this is a classic case of how that happens. What I've always, you know, I've been to Russia. I was actually in Russia about a month and a half ago. What's happening there is very interesting, particularly east of the Urals. The latest rampage that Putin is going on is there's 75 different administrative units, okrugs, krais, oblasts, provinces, republics, and so on. And he's decided to simply eliminate arbitrarily two-thirds of them and reorganize the administration of the former Soviet Union, east of the Urals, along the lines of the old KGB's organizational cartography. Just as the, and believe me, I mean, look, we should all celebrate the collapse of state communism in the former Soviet Union. We should celebrate what little liberty the people have enjoyed since then. But what really has unfortunately happened, particularly east of the Urals, is that this gangster state has emerged. There has been a wholesale expropriation and theft of natural resources, which have been handed over to, in some cases, Japanese crime syndicates in the Russian far, the Sea of Okhotsk, and the Russian Pacific, and so on. Life expectancy for Russian males has fallen to that of the life expectancy of males in Sudan, and it is as though the unforgivable, reprehensible position of the liberal intelligentsia in the 1930s. With respect to the crimes of Stalin and so on, is being repeated in a strange way in the West, because it's sort of triumphalist capitalism has defeated communism sort of narrative that ignores that there's something actually different going on. That's not really what's happening here. What we're seeing there are a couple of things. The mining of all these natural resources, the absolute ravaging of what is left of biological diversity, from saiga antelopes to tigers and so on, the plundering of domesticated species, which are very important, reindeer herds and so on, At the same time, the people there, and this is the result of a number of public opinion polls that were conducted in Khabarovsk and Sakhalin Island and Primorye, interestingly exhibit exactly the same values and desires and hopes with respect to the protection of ecological functioning and so on, as you will find in public opinion polls conducted in Southern California. That everywhere that I looked and everywhere that you go, people actually do, they will respond, for instance, yes, we're not all that concerned about seeing a slowdown in the rate of economic development and growth if that's what it takes to ensure the sustainable harvest of the natural resources around us and the equitable distribution of benefits from the harvest of those resources. And this is something that I find very, very... I think this is actually an important thing to remember, mm-hmm. is that this is not a simple narrative of two legs bad, four legs good. That this is actually... people are ready, people want to be mobilized, people need leadership, and you don't engage in that leadership by telling them that they're crap. You don't engage in that leadership and you don't mobilize people by presenting only a narrative in which we sort of have fought this fall from grace, from this sort of sylvan wonderland to where everything goes from bad to worse. Because, in fact, it's just simply not true. Mm-hmm. In most of the developed world, actually, things have been better. I mean, the Londoners listening to this program should ask themselves, is the air not cleaner here than it was 50 years ago? Is the water not cleaner? Are there not more birds? Yes, there are. So things are actually getting better in many respects. But this is the thing. Wherever you go, you sort of find this desire on the part of people to see some real action on these kinds of issues. But there's very, very little political leadership. And when you look to that political leadership, it's animated by this essentially misanthropic narrative. Mm-hmm. This business, too, about things getting all, things are actually getting better in many respects. Throughout the world, the connection between economic development and energy source depletion, that historic relationship is being broken by new technologies. We have seen, let's face it, 350, 400 million people lifted from abject poverty in Asia over the last 10 or 15 years. It's phenomenal. And those things that we separate out as environmental conditions have also similarly improved throughout much of the developed world over the last 50 years. Where I come from, in many cases, there's more fish, there's more whales, the water is cleaner, there's more birds and all this sort of thing. People are better off. And I think we have to sort of acknowledge that. And there are reasons for that. And the good guys have actually won some victories here, and we should not forget that.
Do you think there's a connection between that kind of progress and things getting better for a lot of people, between that and the extinction of certain languages, certain cultures? I mean, when people stop speaking their languages because they're little tribal languages that they can't use to communicate with the wider world, so they don't use them, the death of that language doesn't mean that they're not communicating anymore. It means they're communicating in a different kind of way. And it might be quite sad to see those libraries disappearing. Yes. And so on. But actually, what comes with that is that people can actually communicate with a wider group of people and interact in a different way and participate in that kind of economic development.
So that's a good thing. That's a very good point. The difficulty is that in unfortunately too many cases, language loss is accompanied or it occurs because the mechanisms of economic development, the levers of economic growth, are controlled by people from away. They're not controlled by people locally. So, I think it is, generally speaking, something to regret, but you're quite right. It's not good enough for us to say, oh, wouldn't it be lovely if we had all these little people in Papua New Guinea and Nigeria and the Eastern Himalayas running around as they were 1,000 years ago, speaking all of these quaint and wholly unintelligible languages.
Yeah, it's all very well for me to say that, because I speak English. So exactly. It's cool.
Well, those people actually want what we've got. They're entitled to what we've got. And I think the great challenge is ensuring that they are allowed to choose those options according to their own lights, by and large. And the other thing is, let's not forget that extinctions are not necessarily a bad thing. Let's all raise a glass to the prospect of the extinction of the AIDS virus. This would be great. This is something to celebrate. So you're right. I mean, it's not that easy, that it's not a matter of this always being a horrible thing. Where I live, for instance, there is a... I really don't know that I would that much regret the extinction of a local population of Puma concolor, which is mountain lions.
Right.
I live in a city of 350,000 people. 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, we had a cougar alert. We had to keep the kids in the house. Cougars like to eat kids. If they go extinct, how, you know, who cares? Let them go. So, you know, it's complicated. And I think we have to recognize that complexity. And I don't, by the way, propose any sort of great course of action or strategy or methodology. The technology already exists. The strategy's already been laid out. It's already there. I just tell these stories, and I'm encouraging people to start to think for themselves, and also to sort of to think out of these arbitrary categories of thought, to get out of the get away from the sort of environmentalism as a separate category of thought, to recognize that the phenomena that we observe and what we have imagined to be the wild world is actually phenomena that is occurring in the tamed world, and that that we are all human beings, human cultures, very much swept up in this phenomenon, this strange sameness, for which we don't really... Certainly, environmentalism doesn't even have a word, doesn't even have a name for it.
Oh, well, let's look at another one of the sort of stories that you cover. You talk about the narrowing of varieties of food crops, be it fruit or vegetables, and I'm sure everybody's familiar now with this desultory range of apples that a supermarket mm-hmm. will sell compared to what used to exist. But there's an interesting distinction here in that these things have come about through an artificial selection, and we created a lot of these things. So why is it a shame? Why do we care that some of these things...
Because they taste better.
That's it. It's as simple as that.
Well, yeah, pretty well. I mean, for instance, in Nagaland, in the eastern Himalayas, where I spent a lot of time with some very interesting people, I think it was 30 different varieties of rice paddy, paddy rice and so on, that they cultivate. Half of them they don't even market because they say, well, no way. I mean, this is too good. We're not going to allow it in. We're going to eat it all. In fact, if we had our way, we'd, you know, plant it all over the place. We need to make some money, and so we sell some people some other stuff, and we get to keep this stuff, and blah, blah, blah. One thing, I'm fortunate enough to sort of live in a place where it's not all that difficult to find what is marketed in cities as sort of organic, mm-hmm. organically chicken or something like this. It's just regular chickens with, you know, these farmers raise where I come from. When you have people from big cities coming over for dinner, you sort of, well, let's get some of those, you know, range hens from next door. And they can't believe what they're eating because they've never eaten anything like mm-hmm. this before. This is actually a place where I actually have a great deal of optimism. People are just sick and tired of eating crap.
Yeah.
So that's a good thing, I think. As far as food crop varieties is concerned, it could well be that a lot of these interesting apple and pear varieties are no longer there because they just didn't taste all that good.
Mm-hmm.
But by the way, I'm not, I'm a big fan of shade-grown, organic, fairly traded Irish whiskey, I should say. And also, that's a little joke I make, one of the things that the United Nations Environment Program actually recommended today, and I don't think people should lose sight of this, is genetically modified foods.
Mm-hmm.
We have to get over it. A lot of these things are luxuries we can no longer afford. We haven't been able to sort of get our heads around this stuff. And, we're not ahead of the curve on this phenomenon.
Well, there's certainly a reluctance. I mean, genetically modified foods are a big sort of bête noire of...
Oh, it's total anathema.
Yeah.
But in fact, now what the United Nations Environment Program is saying, sorry, we're going to have to do this. We cannot feed the people of sub-Saharan Africa without genetically modified organisms. Get over it. And similarly, I think, well, you've got people like James Lovelock, who is now saying unequivocally, you know, nuclear power, sorry. Mm-hmm. You know, it would have been nice if we could get away without it, but... I mean, I'm not so much convinced. It takes so long for nuclear power plants to come on stream, whether or not this is really going to be that much of a of an effective way to address the consumption of fossil fuels. But at least, you know, people are thinking outside the box a little bit here.
Well, we're, as usual, this half an hour, new half an hour format has absolutely flown by, and I've not been able to cover half of the stuff I wanted to. But you've already mentioned this slightly, Terry, but if you can perhaps finish up by telling us if you are confident for the future and sort of optimistic.
Total optimist. Absolute and utter optimist. Don't forget that all these scary headlines always, you know, just for efficiency's sake, usually are absent the subordinate clause that begins, if present trends continue, comma. Present trends are not necessarily going to continue. Mm-hmm. And really, just again, I'm just a bloke. I'm not a scientist. I'm not an ecologist. I just write stories. I go out with a reporter. I write it down. I come back. And all I'm asking is that people think for themselves a little bit and remember that narrative and story is the way we understand the world around us. Hopefully this book makes a tiny contribution to allowing people to sort out in their own ideas, in their own heads, where we're going with all this stuff.
Okay, Terry, thanks very much for being on Little Atoms
today.
Thanks
a lot. Thanks for having me.